This is BPN Radio, your 24-hour internet prayer station, calling America to pray. It's time now for the Christian War Room with your host, Michael Schonborn. Now, here's Michael.
Well, thank you, Dale, for the introduction, and welcome here to BPN Radio, to Seismic Radio. And we've got another evolution talk. Okay, the talk started off with 100 ways to disprove, to kill the theory of evolution. And I think last time we stopped at number 47. Number 47. Got a few more numbers to go through, 50 exactly. And again, when I sort of go through this, it's not a matter of academic study and disproving the scientific views which are there. And I would imagine that somebody who is working in this area, who is working in this field, came around and, you know, would enter into a debate, it might look very, very different. But what I'm appealing to is just a matter of common sense. Very often, and I think this is one of the biggest problems we have in our day and age, we accept things on face value. And I think the masses have been conditioned to not think for themselves, but to just accept. Why do I say this? I mean, I think the educational system has been sort of shaped in this way, in this format, to not think, but to accept. And also, there's been something generated like a blind faith in academia, where there's a consensus about a certain thing, and this consensus has to be abided by. It's almost a little bit like what we had in medieval days, where the Catholic Church had pretty much the say, and if somebody came up, a scientist, and was saying something which didn't fit in within the generally accepted concept of whatever the church was saying, people were in danger of being branded as an heretic, and as a result, probably ending up being burned at the stake. And I think something similar is happening today. Obviously, maybe not to that extent that people are burned at the stake, but there is a consensus, and the consensus goes in a lot of anti-Christian eras or areas. If you don't agree, you're in trouble. And so, for example, if you don't agree that family these days can be defined as a man and a man, a woman and a woman, and you just think that family, like nature suggests, is between a man and a woman, who can produce children and to raise their own flesh and blood in the way they seem fit best. If you stick to this model where, you know, people have been sticking to it for, you know, at least 6,000 years, as far as we can tell. If you uphold this model in favor and against, over and above the other models which are suggested today, you are almost an enemy of the state and you are in trouble. You can possibly expect serious consequences for not accepting this and for not following the agenda and not celebrating this agenda which is pushed down our throats. In the same way with the theory of evolution as well, if you don't accept this, you're considered to be foolish and a bit of an, you know, somebody who's feeble-minded. At best, at worst, you're going to have to suffer consequences, which may affect your career, your professional life. Nevertheless, it's very, very important. And as Christians, we need to stand up, and we need to stand up for the values which are in the Bible. And again, it's important that we pass this on to the next generation. I mean, I'm an old dog now. I'm well past my teenage years, well past my my prime adulthood, and I've got peace with the whole thing. I've listened an awful lot. I've heard an awful lot. I've seen an awful lot. I've seen the world of academia, having been in there myself. I know the corruption which is in the world of academia. And what to think of it. Yeah. I've seen science. I've seen science being flawed. I've seen good science as well. So you've got a lot of experience, and with a lot of experience comes maybe different attitude to the whole thing. Nevertheless, when you look at our younger generation, we've got a different story. So we get people who are just in their formative years, they are, you know, if it's our children, we teach them or try to teach them the right way. Maybe not sufficiently. Maybe not, we don't give them the weapons they need to use to defend themselves or to work out the truth for themselves. Maybe we don't teach them to ask questions, to come up with answers for themselves. And that is all a very big problem. And we need to make sure that that we give them on the way the tools and the weapons to find the truth and to work it out for themselves as far as possible, but also to let them have a reliance on the Word of God and on God Himself, and not to, you know, trust people too far, including maybe ourselves, because very often we don't get things right and we need them to be able to question things and to come to their own conclusions. And foremost, you know, most importantly, to find the truth. And the truth is certainly not the theory of evolution. Once you, it's a nice lid, you know, it's a nice cover. And when you look at it, it looks all very pretty. But once you lift up the cover and you look what's underneath, you find that there is nothing but just a lot of foam, but nothing else. And there's no substance to it. There's no truth to it. And this is pretty much the ultimate reality. Okay, we're going to look at point 48. Point 48 is the whole concept of information. And I want to refer to you to a professor called Werner Gitt, and he is, I think I mentioned him before in this series of talks. He is a German guy from Braunschweig, I think, and sort of he has sort of looked at the whole idea of the theory of evolution, and he looks at just the concept of information. What is information all about? We understand information today maybe better than in any of the generations before. I mean, I'm not the, you know, world's best mathematician by no means, on the contrary. but I've done a little bit of work within data communications, and I understand how data communication works. And a lot of it is, you know, using media or using a medium which is not perfect and which is very lossy, and data can get lost, and yet you build systems inside the information system to maintain the data you are after and you need, so that you can copy, you know, a gigabyte, which is how many bytes? A megabyte is a million. Actually, it's 8 million bits. Yeah. Then you've got a gigabyte. So a kilo is 1,000, mega is 8 million, a giga is 1,000 million bits. Okay, so that is a big number. So we're looking at about, for 1 gigabyte, about 8,000 million bits. It's a big number. It's a very, very big number. And we move them from one system to another, and every bit has to be correct. And if any one of these bits is not correct, the whole data may not work. The whole data flow may not work. All the data may be corrupted. And so we've got systems, you know, consisting of error checking, consisting of validating data, and also consisting of reconstructing lost data. So a typical CD-ROM. And I once tried it out myself when all this came out. A typical CD-ROM, I think it's about a quarter of the stuff that's in there. It's just for error correction. it's got a little crack inside, and normally you would say, oh, this must be a huge chunk of data, but with all the information that's placed on the CD-ROM, it can actually reconstruct the data that is missing from that one particular position or location on the CD itself. And again, when we look at information in the theory, in the concept of life, you know, all the information that is necessary, and again, for a single cell, what we know, we need about 600,000 genes, which need to be in exactly the right position. So that's more than 500,000. All of them need to be in exactly the right position. They need to do exactly the right thing, and they need to, you know, build up proteins in order to make a single cell work. And that's pretty much the lowest form of life. Yeah? Evolutionists make us believe that, you know, all put it together, and suddenly lightning struck, and all these little molecules that were just in the right arrangement, and then it would kick off, and everything was fine and wonderful, and life started, and so on. It's a nice fairy tale, but When you look at the probability calculation of this information to be at the right place in the right position, it's pretty much impossible. You know, it doesn't exist. Yeah, it's a no go. It's a no. It just doesn't work. And again, the same thing as well. When we look at the information which is in the human body, if you uncurl the information, you uncurl all the DNA in a single strand. I think it was Kent Hovind. He made the statement that you could go to the moon and back with just the distance of the amount of information that is in there. I'm not quite sure, you know, whether this comparison is correct or something. But the way we need to to think about it is that there is a huge amount of information. So we are looking at a huge amount of cortex from what we understand today, which has to be in place in order to make life possible. And then, I mean, one thing which always struck me is if you, I was just on the way to work and I thought to myself, if it weren't for the force of life, and if it were not for life form in itself, yeah, all we would have here on Earth is just dust. It's just dust. Nothing else. Nothing else. It's just dust and that's it. And our planet would pretty much look like Mars or, you know, any of the other planets we see in the solar system where nothing is happening. Today I was just listening on the news, and the news said that, you know, they got this Mars rover up there and he's found some microbes, and they are very positive, and it looks like, you know, organic life, organic structure, because there's methane in the atmosphere that suggests that there must be some life. And again, when you really think about it, yeah, when you really think about it, all we know and all we have seen so far is dust. Yeah, we've seen some. I mean, I'm gonna go on a tangent off here. We've maybe seen some UFOs and you know, stuff which shouldn't be there on Mars, on the moon and things like that. So there's a lot of conspiracy theories, some rumors and stuff like that going around. But also what I find very interesting is that more and more of these ufologists, they are now talking that whatever they see is something surreal, and they think it's interdimensional. It's not in our dimension. Anyway, I just leave it as it is. But if life, the way we have it here on Earth, jumped out of or evolved out of nothing, it is pretty much foolishness to try and assume this. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever, even if you had a life form. And I mentioned this many times before, there's never been any you know, crossover from one species to another. And when you look at life, and especially when you look at the theory of evolution, and you look at the concept survival of the fittest, we should have like one or two life forms which are here competing with one another, or maybe depending on one another. But we've got a vast variety of life, and it's, I mean, I'm not living in the most diverse fauna and flora here in England, but when I look out the window and I see all the plants which are there, when I look in my garden, I see all the weeds which are there, it kind of amazes me, the amount of life which is there and which is sort of making itself known. And tries to survive, you know, against all the odds as well. You know, just look at weeds as an example. But all of them have got a phenomenal amount of information, a huge amount of information that is in there. And again, we don't find the transition between all the different plants and how, you know, more information will produce even more information to produce something great and wonderful. And so, again, you know, the presence of all this information which we are dealing with pretty much tells us that there is a designer behind it, or that there is somebody who is giving this information, who is writing those signatures all over the place to let us know there is a God, there is somebody out there who has done it all, and who is to be praised and glorified for everything that is here on this planet. Again, just again, bear in mind, you know, everything you see and everything you can put your fingers on, if you take a life away, all this planet would be is probably just, I mean, we've got a lot of water, the temperatures might be still the way they are today, but it would just be dust and it would be sterile and there would be nothing there. And yet, what we see is that right now, you know, even within you know, environments which are totally opposed to life, there's still life there, you know, in the depth of the sea and in caves and all sorts of other places. Okay, so we got tons of information. Right, the next one is, let me just see whether I can get something up here on Google. And we are at 49, number 49, gradually working forward, working our way forward. And it's the saltiness of the sea. And it's interesting. Yeah? Right, I've got an article here from 2008. And it talks about the climate change making seas more salty. Scientists report increased salinity in oceans can be attributed to man-made climate change. Okay, the first question is why? Yeah, why is it attributed to man-made climate change? It doesn't make any sense. I'm not sure what reasons they come up with, but it's pretty much everything. You know, if anything, any anomaly is climate change. Here we can see one thing, and this is, meanwhile, further south towards the tropics, Atlantic waters have been getting saltier about 0.5% more since 1960s. Again, you know, how can this make more salty? Let me just tell you one thing. Why does the sea get salty? And the idea is very straightforward. Very, very straightforward. We've got minerals and mineral deposits in rock. We've got salt in rocks as well, so natrium chloride. And rivers tend to have sweet water. Sea water tends to be salty. And the reason is that the water washes into the sea, picks up all the minerals and the saltiness, and it dissolves it in the sea. So every year, in other words, the sea should get a little bit more salty. Is there an equilibrium? Yes, the equilibrium is going to be there when there's no more salt left. That's one thing. Then logic says the sea can't get more salty. But what does this tell us? What does the saltiness tell us? And let's sort of think about this for a moment. Scientists say the sea is getting more salty. And let me just try and find out what the salinity of the sea is. How many percent? Yeah. So there's a point where it's fully saturated. So the salinity of the sea is 3.5%. Yeah. So that's 35 grams of salts, sodium chloride, yeah, dissolved in it. So that's 35 grams of salt per liter, yeah, of sodium chloride. Okay, let me just have a look at salinity of the Dead Sea to give you an example. Yeah. Dead Sea. So we've got 3.5%. We know since the 60s it's gone up. The Dead Sea has got a salinity of 33.7%. A hypersaline lake is landlocked body and so on, so on, so on. Yeah, so we've got another figure here as well. So that's 34.3%. Okay, so we've got 3.5% in the oceans. Let me just check out the salinity of the Dead Sea. And it's very interesting when you look at these figures. I'm going to come to a point in a minute. Not the Dead, the Black Sea. Black Sea. Yeah, I know the Black Sea is a little bit more saline than the other one. So, right, what have we got? We have got list of bodies of water by salinity. Okay, we've got Salt Lake and so on. Mediterranean Sea, what have we got? Salinity, grams per kilogram. Right. So we've got 3.5%. Let's have a look at the Mediterranean, whether it's more saline than the others. Right, we got it. Black Sea is going up to 23. So that's actually, I'm quite surprised. It's not quite as saline as the sea. So let's have a look. So that's Mediterranean Sea is 38. So that's in southern Europe and North Africa. And let's have a look. Have we got the Dead Sea here as well? That's grams per kilogram per liter. Baltic Sea is 10. That's interesting. It's not quite as much. So the let's have a look. Oceans. I can't see the Dead Sea is one third, so we've got 337 grams. Let's have a look. Have we got Salt Lake City? Salt Lake. I'm just looking down here. So the Great Salt Lake is 142. Not quite as the Dead Sea. Okay. Right. So that's interesting as well. So Baltic Sea is 10%. Not 10%. It's 10 grams per kilogram. Then the oceans are about 33. Red Sea is 36 to 41. Then we have the Dead Sea is 337. That's the one in Israel. So that's almost one third of it is just a saline thing. Okay. Right, so what point am I making here? I'm spending a lot of time looking at these tables. Now, the point is, first of all, the sea is getting more saline. And one thing we have noticed is that in the last 40 years, actually since the 60s, so let's give it to 60 years. In the last 60 years, it's gone up by half a percentage point. And we have got 3.5%. Again, if it's half of 3.5%, like, depends on how the figures go, we can probably make a calculation and we can come to a conclusion when the sea was actually, like the Baltic Sea, you know, like down to 10 grams per kilogram, or you know, like Sweetwater, where the water was not saline or hardly saline at all. So the point I'm trying to make here is that we can calculate this probably back, and I would have to go through those figures, but it's one of those conduits which I've been talking about before as well, that now if you go into a room and you see a candle burning, like you go to a cabin somewhere in the middle of nowhere in Alaska or someplace in the wilderness, and you're just looking for survival, and you find a cabin, and you need shelter, and you need some way to protect yourself. And what you do is you just go into this cabin, into this log cabin, and you see a candle burning. So you know, and you can draw the conclusion that you know that somebody has been there some time ago, you know? Less than an hour, maybe. Less than, because the candle is still burning, and maybe let's say it's burned half down, but again, you don't know how long it was. You can just assume that it was probably a standard candle. But you know that somebody's been here not 100 years ago, not a million years ago, not 1,000 years ago, but some time ago. And one thing we can tell as well is we've got salinity increasing by about 0.5%, and I'm not sure whether that's 0.5% of the whole. Yeah, so I don't know what saline... you know, saturation is where the point is, or it's just you know, 0.5% of the 3.5%, the current salinity which is there. Now, regardless of which way we're going to use it, so if we say it's a half a percent of 3.5%, we can probably run some figures, and we could say a couple of thousand years back, you know, if we take this, there was no salinity at all in the sea. The sea was sweet; you could drink seawater and survive, not go crazy. Obviously, we know we can't, and the next thing is we know the salinity is increasing, and it's not climate change, it's just a natural process. So based on the salinity of the sea, we can say that the Earth is not millions and millions and millions upon years old, but we can say that there's a time limit on there. And we can see the chondrule. The chondrule has not burned. The candle is burning. The season saturated with saline, with salt. Salt is still sort of getting washed away from the rocks and everything, and is ending up in the sea. And we can see that the salinity of the sea is increasing. And the reason for the salinity of the sea increasing over the last 60 years is down to natural processes, to rivers washing out, salts from the environment. That's what we can see. Whether the rate is constant, of increase in salinity, we don't know. We probably would have to wait another 10 years or 30 years or whatever, or 60 years. We don't know, but we can notice, we can see, we can observe. We see the burning candle, and we know, the Earth is not that old. Otherwise, the salinity would be a lot higher. The saltiness of the sea, just one indicator of many telling us that we are not told the full story. And then they give us other stories, and they say, yeah, salinity is increasing, and it's climate change. It's because you are driving your car, that's the reason why. The saltiness, I'm not quite sure what car fuels have got to do with salinity of the sea. I'm sure they can come up with something, and they can find it. Maybe they would blame it on fertilizers, which could be a reason, but nevertheless, it could just be a natural process. One thing we know, the salinity is not that high. It could be a lot higher. The Dead Sea, we've got a tiny little river Jordan going into the Dead Sea, and the water is evaporating. We've got the big seas, the big oceans, but still we've got water from the land, just rushing in there. And we can see that it does do some changes as far as the salinity is concerned. Okay, I'm going to leave it at this point. Just two points to look for, and to kind of make up your mind and ask some questions. Information. Where does all the information come from? Where does all the information about the plant life, the trees, the humans, the animals, all that stuff? Where does it come from? Yeah, it's not by chance, and it's not by nature. Yeah, it's not by nature. It's by design. It's by God. And then the other one is the burning candle thing, salinity of the sea. The information we get from the scientists is it's increasing. Okay, fair enough. So a long time ago, it would have been a lot lower. Would have been a lot lower. So what can we take from that? what can we take from that? Yeah. I leave it to you to make up your mind on these issues. For me, it's clear. We are looking at a young Earth. We are not looking at millions and millions and millions and millions and millions of years. We are looking at thousands of years, and this is where we are coming from. The Bible tells us that this Earth, the way it is now, was created 6,000 years ago. We had a massive flood. We had a massive upheaval about 4,500 years ago. And a lot of stuff which we see today is just evidence of this massive catastrophe the Earth was hit by. And we need to understand this. Okay, you're listening to BPN Radio. You can pick up these talks and also the other, things about evolution at christianwarroom.com, christianwarroom.com. So I would encourage you to check it out. A lot of other subjects are tackled as well. We are in a war, and this war is... I've got my magic book here, and I think I've written it down somewhere, but I don't know. Yes, it's there. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God, to the pulling down of strongholds, casting down... and I can't read my own handwriting here. Every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God. That's it. Casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God. That's really what we are here for. God bless and thank you for listening here at the Christian War Room.
For the past half hour, you've been listening to the Christian War Room with host Michael Sean Bourne. For more information on how you can participate or find out more about the Christian War Room, simply go to ChristianWarRoom.com. That's ChristianWarRoom.com.